depends too much if you kind of look at me.
Yeah, and just look at me. And yeah, what? I mean, ideally you forget about this. That probably won't happen because there's a very large camera foot from your face. But yeah, just ideally just have a conversation.
Okay.
Great. So today is April the 16th, and this is David Klein. I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina. And if you would introduce yourself, please, and say, you know, when and where you were born.
My name is Nancy Stoller. I was born July 16th, 1942, in Newport News, Virginia, and I grew up in Hampton, Virginia.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell me a little bit about the family in which you were raised and the background, and whether you can see anything from your childhood that may have led you to what you did later?
Uh-huh. Sure. So my parents were both born in New York City. They were both Jewish. And I think my father grew up in a pretty somewhat liberal household. My mother, not quite as much. But my father got a job that brought him to Virginia right after he got out of college. And so they moved to this town, Hampton. And both of them were opposed to segregation. And there were very few Jews in the community also. And my parents were, they were interested in trying to bring a certain kind of environment into our household, which was in contrast to what we were surrounded by. Because in the town that I grew up in, everything was completely segregated. Schools were segregated. All the public accommodations, the neighborhoods were to some extent segregated and in a different way mixed.
Mm-hmm.
And in my house, my parents made it really clear that people couldn't say anything derogatory, that, you know, you couldn't use any really negative words about black people. They taught us to respond when people would say, give excuses for segregation. I remember talking about riding on the bus and asking my mother how to respond when somebody would say the reason the buses are segregated is because you can't tell because black people carry knives. And it could be dangerous if you're white and you sat in with black people. And her response was to say, people that say that, they don't really know anything. And the approach of my family, which was, they're kind of rationalist people, was it's all about ignorance. Prejudice comes from ignorance. And they'd like to drum that into us and drum that into us. Mm-hmm. And I remember...
Did that make sense to you as a
well,
kid?
Well, initially,
yeah.
You know, because they believed the issue was prejudice, and you can counter prejudice, and they had experienced prejudice. Like, for example, in our town, Jews could not... They couldn't go to the country club. They couldn't do this. They couldn't do that. When I was in high school, my high school had sororities, but I didn't understand that Jews couldn't be in the sororities, et cetera. And they would just say, well, that's just ignorance. They don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was in junior high, I remember this guy who was in my class. His name was George Wythe, which is a name of some famous white southerner also. And I remember he was so prejudiced, and he was so smart at the same time. And something told me, you know, it's not ignorance. It's not stupidity. It's something else. And I always kept a hold of that. But in regard to my family, I just want to add something else. And that is that although my father was more kind of retiring, he'd come home from work and read and so on, my mother was involved in the local community. And she and some other folks ended up desegregating the League of Women Voters. She went to a League of Women Voters meeting, and it was all white. And she had heard, I don't know if she belonged to the League of Women Voters in the North or what, but she said, well, isn't this the League of Women Voters? Everybody should be able to come to these meetings. I don't know if she was naive or what, but after a process, they opened up the meetings. And that was the beginning there. And she was also involved in desegregating the Girl Scout Council. And I didn't think too much of it when I was a kid, but I'm sure I was affected by
mm-hmm.
all of this.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what the process was by which, you know, to go about desegregating these things? Was it, I mean, how was she recruiting people? Do you know?
Well, I think in the League of Women Voters,
mm-hmm.
she asked where were the black women. And there was one, and people said, well, you know, I don't know if they said, I don't know exactly what they said, whether it was they don't vote or
mm-hmm.
we don't have that. But she found another friend, and this woman, her name was Harrison, Margaret Harrison, her family, she herself had come from Chicago, but she was married into the Harrison family, which is the same family that produced some presidents.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband was the minister of the Maine Episcopal Church, which was kind of the leading church in Hampton. And she was very strong,
mm-hmm.
I guess I'd have to say, in the community, because her husband was an elite person. And so together, my mother, who brought this, I think, why shouldn't it be that way attitude, and Margaret,
mm-hmm.
who could stand up to critique, were able to somehow open up the meetings so that African-American women came
mm-hmm.
to the meetings. With the Girl Scout Council, I know what happened was that there was a black Girl Scout organization that existed in Hampton, and then there was a white Girl Scout organization, and I don't know if up on the state level or where there was some communication, some national communication. And what my mother did was to make sure that in the local council, like
mm-hmm.
for Hampton, that all of the different troops, even though the troops were still segregated, that all the troops would be represented in the council, so all the troop leaders would come together and meet. And that was a kind of a matter of arguing about how things just should be done.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's how
started
those
at
things
that
were
level,
done.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And those are the two things that were actually pretty significant. This was in
mm-hmm.
the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and anyway, I think I picked up some of that. And when I was in school, like in junior high and high school, I was kind of known as an argumentative person. One of my teachers thought I should be a lawyer, but because I would often take this point of view, and it wasn't very popular
mm.
in my school and with the teachers. Can I tell a story of something that happened when I was in junior high?
Please,
which
yeah.
really affected me when I became part of the movement.
Yeah.
So I was in junior high when the Brown versus Board of Education decision came out in 1954.
Mm-hmm.
I was in junior high. And we had a social studies class. And in that class, sometimes they talk about current events, but there never was really anything big in current events. And one day our teacher came in, I remember it was a guy, and he announced that the U.S. Supreme Court had just issued this ruling saying that classes would have to be desegregated, that the whole school
mm-hmm.
system would have to be desegregated. He was really serious. And we never talked about anything that really happened except for this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said to us, but don't you worry, because this won't happen until both you and I are no longer part of the school system. In other words, the Supreme Court made this ruling, but it's not going to get put into effect. And I remember I was like totally shocked, because I thought, in class we always say, you know what the Supreme Court says, you do,
right.
you know,
right.
but not in this case, they're not going to do it. And as it turned out, in terms of my school and my high school, the high school wasn't desegregated till after I left, which was over 5 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But and some of the schools near us were shut down because the school districts and the counties refused to open them up.
Mm-hmm.
And that struggle actually did go on throughout that time. But later, one of the things that I did when I was active in the movement was to work in Prince Edward County in Virginia, which was one of the counties that was involved in the Brown court case.
Right.
And for me, that was something really very moving about working in Prince Edward County, even though it was horrifying to know that when I was there, which was in 1962, people still had not been able to go to the schools
right.
at that point. But I'll never forget that day in class when we were told this would never get put into effect.
Right. So in this way, I mean, so questions of race and prejudice were raised for you in these ways.
And also my parents used to take us to Hampton Institute, which is now Hampton University, to go listen to culture, like the symphony and musicians who would come to town. And I always thought that we were so lucky that my parents didn't care about going to a black institution, because the symphony didn't come to any white institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And we were often like one of maybe two or three families that were white that would be in the audience at a Hampton Institute. And I think also for me, that maybe helped me to get a sense that there was something about black culture that was something that educated people loved, and I admired my parents.
Right.
And also that there was something special that if I could cross over this barrier, that I could be exposed to things that were not available to me in the white world.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another kind of exposure.
So did you identify as a Southerner or a Virginian, or as some sort of other category in between?
Well, when I would make some of these comments, you know, prejudice is bad or something like that, or when one of the critiques, of course, that people would make to you is, well, you're just a Yankee. And I would point out that I was born and raised in the South. And even if my parents were born somewhere else, you couldn't call me a Yankee because I was a Southerner. An interesting thing for me was that when I would go to New York to see my cousin, they would always tease me for my Southern accent. And when I was in the South, I'd be teased for not having enough of a Southern accent.
Right.
So I used to like try to modulate it.
Right.
But I think that when you have a difference of opinion, sometimes people will use whatever they can to delegitimate what you're saying. And I think that was part of it. And I'm aware that if I'd had different parents, of course I'd have been a really different person.
Mm-hmm.
It would have turned out. I don't know how it would have turned out. There's no way you can ever tell that.
Mm-hmm.
But I always felt that logic was something I could believe in, and I was always taught to challenge it. Maybe that's also part of some of the Jewish tradition,
mm-hmm.
as well, of argumentation being not only acceptable but rewarded,
mm-hmm.
Up to a certain point. So,
in which case you're a wiseacre.
Yeah, something like that, or you've just gone too far,
right.
Or power comes down on you. But when my teacher said, well, you're so argumentative, you should be a lawyer. I didn't take that as a criticism. I took it as a compliment. And I think in a certain way he meant it as a compliment, even though he wanted me to stop talking. You know, and I didn't become a lawyer. But I felt it was a compliment to my intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And it encouraged me to continue and debate and to have confidence in my own opinions and not be afraid. And that was another thing about being Jewish, I think, is that my parents, who were both atheists, sent my brothers and me to a kind of a Jewish Sunday school because kids on our street, when we were little, like 5 and 6 years old, used to tease us. And they did, you know, taunt us by saying, "You killed Christ," you know, "You killed Christ." And that was in response to why we explained why we didn't go to Sunday school, because we were Jewish. And when we came back home, my parents had this big discussion about whether we should get educated about being Jewish. And it was interesting because my father didn't want us to get educated about being Jewish because he was so, he wasn't religious, even though I came from a Jewish background. And my mother thought it was important to protect us so we would understand a little bit more, and we could at least say, what is it to be Jewish?
Mm-hmm.
We were quite distressed because that meant every Sunday we had to go to the school. but I'm glad that I learned something about that background.
Right.
And
were there other? Did you go to a synagogue or anything like that as well?
Well, the Sunday school was part of the synagogue, and
mm-hmm.
in this whole area of Hampton, there were only maybe 30 or 40 Jewish
mm-hmm.
families out of. Right when we lived there, there was maybe 7,000 people in the town, and then in the surrounding area, maybe 20,000. So there was one synagogue. It was an Orthodox synagogue. There were no Reform, no Conservative, no other Jewish institutions. And so everybody, if they did anything, belonged to that synagogue, and the rabbi included everybody. He didn't care who you were. You were part of the community. And that was also a really good thing for me to experience, I think. So nobody went to services in my family. My brother didn't get bar mitzvahed. But we went to the Sunday school to know something about the community and maybe meet some of the other
mm-hmm.
people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with my parents, a lot of their friends were Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because they had some cultural commonalities. I think, you know, I've maybe affected a little bit.
Right.
None of my personal friends were Jewish, because we were my brothers and I were the only Jewish kids in our high school, except for one other kid.
Right.
So, so all our friends were.
Now, did you have, did you know any black kids growing up, or have any black friends?
The only black friend that I had at all was somebody I met through the Girl Scouts, through participating in something called the National Girl Scout Roundup.
Mm-hmm.
And her troop, we had a patrol that came from our town, and she was from one troop and I was from another, and we got to know each other. But other than that, I never knew any black young people.
Mm-hmm. And then you went away to school?
So after I graduated from high school,
right.
my parents were, my father got transferred to Washington, D.C. for his job. He worked for the government. He was a space scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was in charge of moving us, or finding the place where we'd live. And she insisted that our family would not stay in Virginia because she considered such a racist place to live. It was fascinating to me that she would make that decision, because I had grown up, even though I knew she was critical, I never knew how much she disliked it, that she wanted to move out of the state. So we were either going to live in Washington, D.C., or we were going to live in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, we ended up moving to a little community called Bannockburn, which was in Bethesda, Maryland, in Montgomery County,
mm-hmm.
and it was right down the block from the Glen Echo Amusement Park, which is where I got involved in that part of the movement, which I can tell you about. But meanwhile, that happened the summer after I went to college. So I went away to college. I didn't want to go to college in Virginia, and I applied to a bunch of colleges, and I got in. One of the ones that I got into that I chose to go to was Wellesley College, which right outside of Boston. And so I went there. I was really nervous because I went to public high school and so on and so forth.
And you had your modulated Virginia accent.
Of course. And not only did I have a modulated Virginia accent, but when I got to Wellesley, I got put into a speech class. And I said, what am I doing in the speech class? And it was explained to me that it was because of my accent. So I refused to stay in the class. I was so irritated, you know. And I felt really alienated when I was there because I was a Southerner, because I was a public school graduate. I didn't know anything about people coming out. I knew this stuff, you know, coming out, meaning debutantes. And I felt, I was there because I thought I'd get a really good education. And it was kind of hard for me to make friends when I first got there. I couldn't really relate to the people that I knew that were on my floor.
What year did you start?
I started in 1959. And but one thing that happened was I got involved in the campus newspaper. I wanted to do something. And 1st of February, when the Woolworth sit-in happened in Greensboro, I was working with the newspaper, and I recruited two other people from the paper, and we went off the campus over to the Woolworths right in town, in the town of Wellesley, and we had a sympathy picket. And I couldn't resist, because to me, I think one of the reasons it was important to me was because I came from the South, and most of the people that of the Southerners that I knew at Wellesley, they were like not political at all. And I just felt like it was my opportunity and responsibility at the same time. And so I got these other folks, and we went down there, and we made signs, and we walked back and forth, and of course, immediately we got called into the Dean of Students.
Was it just the three of you, or did it grow?
There were three of us, and then we had maybe a total of six people. And we did for like 3 or 4 days, maybe for the week, something like that. And it was fabulous. We had such a great time.
Now, did you have a sense of that there might be other sympathy pickets going on in other places?
Oh, of course. No, we knew. We knew. It was already being covered in the paper. It probably wasn't 3 days later that we went down there. But it, you know, there was already this national coverage. I mean, when I think of the movement, when people get up and they say, well, it's so fabulous what people did in Greensboro, of course it's important, but the reason, in my mind, that we ended up with a movement is not just because of what people did there, but because it was covered, and because people found out about it. And you can say it was a certain moment in time, but if there hadn't been the coverage that there was, that brought it to this community and that community, and then people all around the country began to hear about it. And like when I heard about it, I already knew there were sympathy pickets, you know, and that it had spread to these other, not only to other Woolworths in the South, but in the North where you could go inside, sit down, there were the sympathy pickets. So I said, well, we have one right down the street. Of course we're going to do something. And anyways, we had a great time, and
then got called in to see the.
We got called in to see the dean, and she. You have to understand that at that time, at this particular college, it's a women's college, and if you went into town, you're supposed to wear a skirt, and if you were wearing pants, not a skirt, you're supposed to wear a long coat that came down to your knees. So when. And you weren't supposed to do anything to upset the local community. So we were called in and we were told, first of all, you're disturbing the people who live in Wellesley, and the college has good relations and you shouldn't be doing that. And secondly, if you think you want to do something about civil rights, you should confine your actions to the campus. So what we did is we continued our picketing for the rest of the week, and we started a civil rights group on campus. And that group, which I was involved with all the time I was in college, one of the first things we did was to talk to the African American students who were on campus, and there was a quota of African American students at Wellesley at the time. There were about 1,700 total students, which means there were like maybe, you know, 400 or 500 students entered in the first year class, but there were only 3 black students in that class. Now, if you look at Wellesley College, it's totally, totally different. But at that time, there was a quota. There was also a Jewish quota, but I wasn't aware of it. I just thought there, from my experience, there are few Jews anywhere,
right.
Because I grew up in a place where there's hardly any, so I didn't even notice that. But so one of the things that we did was we talked to black students on campus about what are the concerns that you have, and one of the concerns that people had was that when family members would come to visit, sometimes these kind of like little boarding houses or bed and breakfasts or people in these houses near the college who would rent out rooms for visitors wouldn't rent to black family members or boyfriends or whoever would come to see people. And so we decided to get the people who wanted to post their rooms for rent with the college to have them sign a non-discrimination pledge. So we informed the Dean of Students that we were going to do this. And the Dean of Students said to us, or if it wasn't her, it was someone else, that this was not a good thing to do because it assumed that people wanted to discriminate and that we needed to make them sign something to promise that they wouldn't do it. Well, so my arguing skills came in good then, not when I was like, if they don't discriminate, well, that should be a selling point. You know, we're not forcing them to not discriminate or anything like that. We're advertising how good they are. So we did go around and finally get the college to accept that everyone who wanted to advertise their rooms would have to sign a non-discrimination agreement. So that was one of the things we did. And we also got involved with other activities. We got involved with the movement in the South in various ways and support, and with activities that were going on in Boston and the black community, which were mostly things about economics and access to jobs and stuff. But in some ways, I'd say that's how I got started. Mm-hmm. And at various times, I was the head of the group. The group was usually pretty small, maybe, you know, 10 people. There weren't very many black students, so usually there was like two.
Right.
And maybe 5 or 6 white students and in the group. And they just organized different things.
Were there other Southerners in
that group? That were in the group?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. It was a long time ago. You know, we're talking 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Could maybe go back and find out more of it somehow.
Yeah.
But it was great. One thing nice about that group is I got to meet a lot of, not only did I meet some interesting people at the college, but I kind of, it was part of developing my identity for who I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to meet people in Boston. I got involved in a number of movement things through that. That's how I ended up going to Prince Edward County to work in the Freedom Centers there.
Mm-hmm.
And through a joint project of the Northern Student Movement and Prince Edward County Christian Association, I think the American Friends Service Committee was also involved in that in 62.
Mm-hmm. And you got involved with them originally in Boston, or with
for that particular project,
right.
I got involved through Boston because it was a summer project and they were recruiting from the Boston area. A number of the people who were in that project were Harvard University students that were either in graduate school, a couple of students from a law school. I think I was the only person that came from Wellesley, and maybe the Northern Student Movement chapter was associated with Harvard,
mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure. But I knew the people because I was involved in different activities, and they wanted to recruit students from Wellesley, so people heard that I was there. They contacted me. I brought people from Wellesley into some of these
mm-hmm.
Projects that happened in you know, in the city, in Cambridge and in Boston. And I also got involved in the group called the Boston Action Group, which was an economic boycott group. That was fabulous. That was a group. There, a group of young radicals, predominantly black, who worked with the Black Ministerial Alliance, mm-hmm. and what we would do through BAG mm-hmm. is that we would identify a particular potential for a consumer action, consumer boycott, and let's say milk, because involved one that involved a place called Hood Milk, and we knew that this company did not hire African Americans at the same rate as whites, and if they were hired, they were hired in worse positions. So my job was usually, especially, to do research. Mm-hmm. So, for example, at Hood Milk, I called up, I made an appointment. This is like an example when we were talking to SNCC about how you just went out and did it. You didn't know what you were doing, but somebody said, okay, well, you're going to do this, you're white, you could do this, in my case, like that. So I called up and I said I was a college student at Wellesley, which was true, and I was doing a study of automation, and I'd like to come to their processing plant and see how it went. So I got there, and they took me through on the tour, and I'm, like, writing notes, and I'm writing, you know, three white people, one black person, two blacks, six whites, and so on and so forth. They give me my little Hood Milk cap, and so on and so forth. And so then I came back to the meeting, and I said, this is exactly how many people work there. And I would ask questions, like, how many people work here? What do you think is, you know, what's going to be the impact of this kind of automation, and so on. So I have really good information. So I report. So together, people in the back would meet with the Ministerial Alliance about how many positions we should ask for, which should we felt be appropriate to the proportions of people in the area, and acknowledging the fact that a lot of people who bought Hood Milk were African American. So, so then the Ministerial Alliance would meet with the company. So they met with Hood Milk, and they said, this is what we need and want. Of course, Hood Milk had no idea how they knew all this stuff. But nevertheless, you know, they made these demands, and they said, you know, we'd like to straighten it out. And, well, they said, no, we can't do that. So they said, well, we're going to have a consumer boycott. Mm-hmm. And so the ministers in the Ministerial Alliance announced the boycott in church and recruited members of the church to participate, and people in BAG, including me and other people, we went door to door and leafleted. So we would leaflet first one neighborhood, then another neighborhood. And the reason the boycott was so successful, we also did one on in the bread industry in Boston, was so successful because people could switch to a different company. They didn't have to drink Hood Milk, they could drink some other. They didn't have to eat Wonder Bread, they could eat another kind of bread. And one of the things that was great is that the Harvard Business School, they used to do these case studies, and they decided to do a case study about these boycotts, and somebody wrote it up in some big journal, and they demonstrated that, through some research that they did, that people didn't go back to the previous, like they wouldn't go back to Hood Milk, they wouldn't go back to the Wonder Bread once they got used to drinking something else or eating something else. And so people were able to use the results of our organizing to make it clear to other companies that people at Harvard Business School proved that this was effective, and you better not have them boycott you because you're going to permanently lose the business.
Right.
That was great. Anyway, that was another some of the projects I was involved in the Boston area. This is nothing about the South.
No, that's great. Well, I mean, we're leading up to, I guess, to Prince Edward County. And
okay. Well, now, first we're leading up to Glen Echo Park.
Okay. Okay, right. You're right. Yes.
So, after my first year at Wellesley, I went home. I spent about 6 weeks in New York. And then I came home. My parents were living in this area, right next to Glen Echo. And there had been a sit-in at Glen Echo, and I think it was on July 4th. It's a big amusement park just outside of D.C., the only amusement park, as far as I know, that was close to D.C., completely segregated. A group of people connected to Howard University, Nonviolent Action Group, was one of the groups that had already gotten active starting in February, had come out and had a sit-in. Of course, people did not get in, and so they started a picket line. So every day during the summer, there was this picket line. So I got back from New York, and the next day, I went down to the picket line. It was only about a 10-minute walk from my house. You know, some people talk about, you're just lucky. You either get dragged in or you happen to be on something. So I was just extremely lucky when I got there.
But it also shows your interest.
Oh, well, of course I was interested.
Right. I mean, you were on your summer vacation. And
that was like, right. Yeah. And I introduced myself. I asked if I could join the line. People said, of course. And they gave me some sign or something like that. And that is where I spent the rest of my summer. Mm-hmm. I had to do work in the morning. And every afternoon, during the week, the picket line would start about 4 in the afternoon and go till the park closed, which I think was about 9 or 10 o'clock, mm-hmm. right when it got really dark. And so all these people in NAG were there. And the people in the organization were Stokely Carmichael, at different times, Courtney Cox, Ivanhoe Donaldson, Hank Thomas, who was one of the first people, or one of the people who were part of the founding of SNCC. He was the representative that came to the SNCC meeting in Raleigh. A bunch of other people, mm-hmm. white and black. Mm-hmm. And so what we would do is we would meet typically on the line, and people would begin to kind of accumulate later after they got off work or school or whatever they were doing. And so by 7 or 8, most of us would be there, and there'd be anywhere from 10 to 30 people who'd be walking the line. And I don't remember that. I don't think we had an office right at that time yet, but we had some places where we go.
This was
in 1960.
So that's your first year.
Yeah. And then, as somebody reminded me the other day, this guy Paul Dietrich, who was a white guy, was a little bit older than the rest of us, he worked at some bar or something, or a restaurant, and sometimes we would meet there. And anyway, so after the park would close, we would go out and get something to eat or go to somebody's house or something like that. And so we used to have nighttime sit-ins. And one of the ones that I really remember well was when we went to a bowling alley in Prince George's County in Maryland, which it was considered to be a much more redneck place. Mm-hmm. And we must have got there about 10 o'clock. And there were two carloads of us, I remember that. And the white members of the group went in and got the tickets and the shoes and stuff like that. And then the black members came in and we were all there. We started to bowl. Nobody seemed to notice. It was a pretty new bowling alley, so we kind of thought maybe it would be open. Mm-hmm. And then somebody behind the desk realized that, we weren't supposed to be there. So they told people to leave. They called the police. Finally, the police came, and they arrested all the guys. They kind of threw us out of the bowling alley. I remember my job was to collect the shoes and take them back. So we did everything very, very slowly, in order to make it last as long as possible. I remember I was carrying the shoes back to the counter And one of these, it must have been these sheriff's deputies, you know, got really angry and hit my hands with the shoes. And all these shoes flew out everywhere, which I found extremely exciting. You know, it was kind of scary, but it was, you know, it was fun also. And then they took the guys in a police car, and I remember this guy, Paul, gave me the keys to his car and asked me to drive, to follow to the jail. Mm-hmm. It was a stick shift. I did know how to drive, but I was so terrified. It was so hard for me to, like, put my foot on the clutch.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just shaking and shaking. And then I did get pulled over by one of the sheriff's deputies. And I was just terrified.
Mm-hmm.
And I...
were you alone in the car, or were there...
I think I was by myself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There might have been another woman in the car with me. Because most of the people... all the guys got arrested.
Right.
And I don't remember, because I was so nervous and focused on this cop. And so I had to get the registration. I didn't even know what it was because it wasn't my car.
Right.
Anything. So anyway, I got a ticket for having a light that wasn't strong enough over my license plate. So that was a classic, you know,
right,
thing.
Right.
And then we went to the jail. The next day I was involved. I called the lawyer. The next day I was involved in bailing out people and taking them home. And the local paper, because I did the official bailing out, they published my name and address. And I don't know if they published my phone number, but the next night, somebody called up in the middle of the night and kind of threatened my parents and so on and so forth. One reason I tell this story is because some people think that in the sit-in movement, it was always, okay, let's go to this particular place, let's go to that place. Or I always thought, you know, like it's in the daytime or something.
Right.
But there were, I think, many, many occasions where people acted in a almost a spontaneous way. We didn't know we were going to go bowling, but we figured as long as we were going to go bowling, we would either... that our goal was to open yet another place for people to go bowling, and there was a way in which we really hoped that we would be desegregating the bowling alley,
mm-hmm.
not having a sit-in and so on. The bowling alley did end up being desegregated, but it was, to me, it also shows something about the kind of recklessness
mm-hmm.
that people in SNCC could engage in. No, it was just like, you know, and that was part of the beauty of SNCC as well.
Mm-hmm.
I also participated in some of the Route 40
mm-hmm.
Sit-ins. I also, through NAG, we did this kind of hit-and-run approach that some people talk about in Baltimore because the police were supposed to read your rights before they arrested you. And we would go in, sit down, wait. The owner would call the police. The police would have to come and read you your rights, and then we would get up and leave. So, and then we go to another place and hope the police don't, you know, we try to kind of sneak around and go to this other place. So then there'd be another hour or two of disrupting this other place. So I participated in those. I was in Cambridge very, very briefly. You know, we just did a lot of different things. I was involved in some of the food drives, the food and clothing drives where we sent supplies down to Mississippi and
mm-hmm.
other places where people had been kicked off their the plantations where they were sharecroppers because they had tried to register to vote or did something. So that was, I kind of did that all through my college years. Whenever I was not actually in school,
mm-hmm.
I would... be doing something that had to do with the movement. I'd either be doing something with the Nonviolent Action Group or go to Prince Edward County like I did for a summer. And then after I graduated, I did go to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
I took off from graduate school for about 10 months to go, and I worked for SNCC as a field staff in Arkansas.
Oh, wow.
And that was in 1964-65. But it was my whole kind of social, political life. I was either involved in the movement in Boston, or I was involved in the movement in D.C., or further south, or in the rural south.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I spent my,
yeah,
my years from 1960 to, I think, well, 66. And then I started doing other different kinds of things that related to the movement, but weren't but they weren't part of SNCC.
Right. Well, let me ask you, I mean, I want to hear a little bit more about that 10 months that you spent. But I also want to ask you about these other things and how you might see movement work relating, different kinds of movement work relating to each other. But can you tell me just a little bit about that?
About which?
The 10-month period.
So it was... in 1963, when I graduated, there was some version of the Freedom Rides going on. There always seemed to be one. Another. And I really wanted to go. My father had just died, and I told my mother I was planning to go, and a friend of hers grabbed me and said, "You cannot leave and do this right now." And so I vowed that the next year I would go. I would be down south because I really wanted to be there. And that was a very powerful, intense time. So for various reasons, I couldn't go until the following December, a year later. And I didn't go to the Mississippi Freedom Summer, and I was doing other things. And I remembered talking to Stokely, and who was a friend of mine throughout that whole period, and telling them I was interested in doing something for SNCC, and what did he think would be a good thing to do. And I knew they had too many people in Mississippi, and so I said, you know, I'll go wherever you think there's something useful to do. So he said, well, we need somebody who can, who's organized and can take responsibility in Arkansas to coordinate the activities of our freedom schools, freedom centers in Arkansas. So would you be willing to go there and do that? And so I said, sure, why not? So I went to Arkansas starting in December of 64, although first I went to the Waveland meeting, which I have to say was an incredible, powerful experience for me, even though I had been to a lot of small-scale SNCC meetings. And that was, I think, a crucial meeting in the history of SNCC also. I feel very lucky that I was there, even though it was so intense and so difficult in many, many ways, with SNCC dealing with the consequences of the Mississippi summer, all the violence and brutality, and people were so burnt out, totally. And then there was the issue of the volunteers who refused to go home. I mean, people fought over that. There was a question of north-south. There's a question of people who are educated and from the colleges versus local people. And so all those issues, the questions of democracy and hierarchy and independence and stars versus the non-stars, like all those things were being argued there. And meanwhile, people were just exhausted also. So I feel like for me, going from there to Arkansas was like going into a really, really quiet place, because Arkansas was, even though there was a lot happening, Arkansas was spared a lot of what people were going through in Mississippi and Alabama and Southwest Georgia. mm-hmm. and especially in Mississippi, which was right next door, but a totally different world. Mm-hmm. Part of what I did when I was there was to communicate with people who were who are our supporters. For example, in Detroit, and the Detroit Friends of SNCC took some special interest in Arkansas, or maybe they were assigned it by mm-hmm. SNCC or something. Mm-hmm. And we also had good relations with the UAW there. And the UAW sent us a bunch of fast cars and a fabulous yellow truck, which got assigned to me. It was a 3/4-ton Dodge truck. And it was so powerful, I had to start in second, and especially when it wasn't loaded. And it got assigned to me because my job was to get the supplies distributed out to Gould and Pine Bluff and West Helena, Bar City.
Where were you based?
I was based in Little Rock.
Okay.
So that was our central office. So I would coordinate the things that came in. I'd make sure that the different places had the supplies that they needed. And then within the office, I also worked on a newspaper that we had, which we called the Arkansas Voice. It was modeled on SNCC's The Student Voice. Mm-hmm. And so I worked on that. I learned how to, you know, set the type and arrange things and write articles and stuff like that. And then all of us in the office participated whenever there was some kind of demonstration. We needed to mobilize people. And so I was involved in the sit-ins that we had in the state capitol at the cafeteria there. I think it was the most significant direct action that happened while I was working mm-hmm. for SNCC in Arkansas. The cafeteria in the state house was segregated, so nobody black could go into this cafeteria. It was like a little tiny place, like as big as a medium-sized office, mm-hmm. and had a little cafeteria line, and people could pick up stuff and then take it somewhere and eat. I believe there were even some tables right outside, little tables. And it was in the basement of the state capitol. And NAACP had already challenged the segregation and the Public Accommodations Act, but it was just languishing in court. Nothing was happening, nothing was happening. And somebody came into our office one day, or somebody brought it up and said, you know, this is outrageous, this is in the state capitol. So somebody got the idea that we should go down there and have a sit-in, and we should do something. So we spent a couple weeks planning this, and some of the white members of our group went, and I was one of them, went in and we bought food, kept our receipts to prove that we were being served. And African-American member of SNCC went in and didn't get served, so we had this evidence.
Right.
And immediately thereafter, after his experience, we had to sit in right there, or a stand-in, because we had to sit.
Right.
We're just standing at the door. So they closed the doors, and we had done a lot of planning, and we had also recruited people from Little Rock community who were supportive of SNCC and what we were doing. And so there were a number of people there, maybe 20 of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had these guidelines. Well, if they arrest you, do this. If you're just going to stand there, do that. If they do this, so we're standing there. And we had the lawyers and all that kind of stuff. Well, all of a sudden, they tell us to leave, you know, and be dispersed and so on, and you're going to be dispersed if you don't disperse yourself.
Right.
And the next thing we knew, these state troopers, because we are in the state capitol, of course, come down the stairs and start beating the shit out of us and dragging us up the steps and throwing us out onto the steps of the capitol. So, and anybody that came back down the stairs just got beat up and thrown out again. So, but they couldn't open the cafeteria because we would be back down there. So that was the first day. So, you know, we were like, well, we can't just let them get away with this. So we recruited more people and we came back the second day. Well, one of the things that happened was that the local people who would come with us, some of them did not want to go back and get beaten up again.
Right.
So we recruited people from Pine Bluff, and we recruited people from West Helen. But those of us who were the kind of core, the staff, our summer I guess it was still spring, it was in March, our volunteers, you know, we went back each day. So we went back, the second day, same thing happened. And, you know, it was being covered in the Arkansas papers, but it was the same week of the Selma to Montgomery March. So there was no national publicity. But we felt we had to keep going back. You know, it was kind of scary. And so we went back the third day. So we go back the third day with all the people we could muster. And on that day, somebody in a crowd threw something like tear gas or something else. I'm not quite sure what it was. Some people said, oh, it's like mustard gas, but I know it could be mustard gas, but you'd die. You know, but it was something. And the state troopers, as well as those of us who were in the demonstration, they inhaled this because they didn't do it. And so some of them went to the hospital to be treated. And so the governor was Orville Faubus at the time. And he officially, of course he was the person who had sent all these troops in there, he officially closed the cafeteria because somebody had gotten hurt, meaning his police. So it got closed. And then of course, you know, people were hurt and so on and so forth. But then within, I'd say, a week or 2 weeks, the federal judge, I don't know if it was a federal judge or a state judge, the judge who was in charge of this case that had been brought to him by the NAACP, held a hearing within like a week or 2 weeks at the most, held the hearing. We came in and testified about what had happened. It was clearly a violation of the law. And the judge ordered that the cafeteria would stay closed permanently or it'd have to open to everyone. That's the law. So another week later, cafeteria opened, it's desegregated. We went in the first day, so you know, to test it, and stayed desegregated after that. And I thought that was such a, you know, it showed the learning that had occurred. I mean, we didn't know we would get beaten up and thrown out, but how people had kind of almost institutionalized certain aspects of sit-in to know how to work it. And it also showed the cooperation between, say, the NAACP, which filed the lawsuit to implement the Public Accommodations Act in that area, and the direct action. And if it hadn't been for the direct action, it wouldn't have happened. It would have just languished and languished and languished because somebody had to push it.
Right.
But once it got pushed, there was something that was already there. I mean, to me, at the time, the most important thing was that we pushed it. But I know that you can see it was a group effort. So anyway, there were a lot of other things that happened when I was there. My boyfriend at the time was African American. I later was married to him. He came to work in the summer. I was there earlier, and he was assigned to a different location because people were afraid if we were together too much, that because he was black and I was white, that it would cause some difficulties. And so he worked away from Little Rock. We didn't see each other too much.
Did you encounter those difficulties?
No, because we were apart. I know one of my white female colleagues had a local black boyfriend where she worked in another town. And we were just talking about this recently, where she was saying to me, and we rode around on a motorcycle together, but nothing ever actually happened. Can you dress up a second?
Sure.
I want to ask you a question before I have one other thing about that. So.
Oh, I got to change the TV.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then, okay.
It's on.
Oh, so I did write an account for mm-hmm. this book that's going to be it's going to have stories of people in Arkansas that this woman Jennifer Wallach is putting together.
Okay.
And so in my account, I talked about this experience where I got raped while I was working for SNCC, and I think I'm going to talk about it here.
Okay.
Also.
Okay. Great.
I mean, really, it's an oral history, you might as well tell the truth.
Yeah, that's great. I admire you.
It's a positive story about Smith. Believe it or not. From my point of view, it's a positive story. I've told it to my students. I just don't want to miss my class. That's why I was looking at my...
Are you going over to the hotel?
Yeah.
Or
you,
okay.
Because
I'm headed there, too, so I can always give you a ride.
Oh. I think the bus leaves at 6.
I think so.
So I don't think that'll be a problem. Because it's 4:45.
I usually work exclusively with audio, so.
Oh, so
this
like
is
little,
all. This is all.
It's a little different.
This is a little different for me being the video part.
Okay.
So. Tape 2, and it's April 16th, and Nancy Stahl.
Okay. So, you know, working for SNCC in Arkansas was, for me, it was very different than the work that I did in the D.C. area, or I think in some ways the work that I did when I was working in Farmville in Prince Edward County, because in Little Rock we were in a big city, and our housing, where I was staying, was in kind of a small apartment complex right across the street from Philander Smith College, which is a black college in Little Rock, or was a black college in Little Rock. And so there were a lot of students that lived in the housing complex also, and we would go to parties, and I remember also, the walls in the apartment were kind of thin. Every morning, I would wake up to "My Girl," the song "My Girl."
Right.
And
right.
That was my wake up alarm. I loved it. I knew every line. And our neighbors taught me how to play Bid Whist, you know, a black game that I never knew anything about before. And it was kind of great to be there in some ways, although I had also stayed at different times and like going out into the field further from Little Rock in people's homes, which I think is more typical of what we think about in terms of SNCC and where you're living with a family. And
right.
When I worked in Prince Edward County, I lived with family also. But anyway, one night I got my roommate and I, another white staff person, a woman, we got invited to a party, and I think there were some other SNCC people that came to the party also. And after the party, one of the guys that I had met there, he was a student at Philander Smith, and he'd been to some of our activities and so on. And he walked me back to my apartment. And when we got to the door, he tried to kiss me. And I wasn't really interested in it. He forced himself into my apartment and basically what happened next was that he raped me. And the things that I remember about it, one of them is that I was in this apartment complex and there was a window in the room.
Mm-hmm.
He pushed me into, it was a one-bedroom apartment, he pushed me into the bedroom. And, you know, and it was like saying things like, oh, I know you're interested and all this kind of stuff. And I remember going over the window and calling out the window, calling, help, help, I need some help, somebody help me. And nobody responded. And everybody in the complex knew that this was a SNCC apartment. It was not possible for people not to know, because everybody else in the complex was black, and in our apartment there were two white women and occasionally black and white men also staying there, you know, because people would sleep on the floor and so on. And I thought, well, there's nothing I can do except, like, you know, try to keep this guy from assaulting me. And so finally, because I felt like there was nobody I could turn to, I, you know, ended up with him raping me. And then when he was done, he just got up and walked out the door like it was this, oh, you know, I know you say no, but, you know, that doesn't mean anything. That's just, you know, like some guys would say, you know, women say no, but that's just what they say because they feel they have to say that. And so I remember I was like, I was stunned because I had been in the movement. I knew lots of black men. I never was afraid. I always felt that, people I didn't really know, I always felt we were in the movement, I could trust everybody. Mm-hmm. And that was always my experience. And I think that what had happened in this situation was that for this particular guy, he saw me as an available person and vulnerable in some ways because I was white. And maybe appealing for that reason. But I don't mean appealing like I was necessarily attractive, but appealing as a kind of like a notch in your belt, something like that. I had sex with this white SNCC worker, you know, this white woman. But, I mean, I don't know everything that was in his mind, but I do know that he had been active in our stuff, and to me that was kind of like a protection or something like that. I didn't know what it was. Right. So then my roommate came back, and I talked to her about what had happened, and the question was what to do about it. And I felt like, obviously, I couldn't go to the police. You know, that would be damaging to everybody. If they even paid attention to it, it would be damaging to our movement. If I identified him, which I certainly could identify him, I knew his name and everything. I mean, it would be, that's like a horrible circus, whatever it was, and it would be, you know, it would be like, you know, on one hand it could be, here's this black man who rapes this white woman. On the other hand, it could be this white woman who's a total slut. And whatever it is, it would have been terrible for the movement. So what I did is I talked to some of the people in SNCC that I knew and cared about and felt I could trust. And so I decided, and after talking with them, I said what I wanted was for this guy to be banned from anything that SNCC ever did. And for some of the guys in our project, African American, to go tell him that everybody knew what he had done. It wasn't a secret. He wouldn't be able to keep it a secret. And we never wanted him to come to our office. He could not participate in anything. And because we were, as an organization and as a collection of activities, people from Philander Smith wanted to be associated with us. People were proud to be identified with us. So it was, you know, it meant something to say that he couldn't participate. And on the other hand, I also felt that, or in addition, I guess, I also felt that we were a nonviolent movement. I'm a nonviolent person, and I couldn't see violence, although people did offer to beat the shit out of, you know, and I could see how that could be appealing. but I couldn't condone that. And as far as I know, it was never done. Afterwards, just a few people in SNCC knew about this, and in our project. And I didn't want too many people to know because I didn't want it to become a big thing. And maybe that was partly about myself, protecting myself, but it was also because I felt that these are the kind of stories, you know, about somebody being raped while they're part of the movement that can be used against the movement. Or could have been used then or could still be used now. And to me, I consider what happened afterwards a kind of a success of the movement, of dealing with a difficult situation, not turning to the police or law enforcement, because you know that law enforcement is your enemy. And you couldn't not know that if you were involved in the movement or if you live in the black community. And so the question is, you know, what is the effective and responsible way to handle this? We didn't have community boards or, you know, some kind. We didn't have reparative justice movement.
Right.
This was the best we could do, you know. And I felt that that was a lesson that I took, which I brought into my work later, which is community solutions to violence. And for years, though, I really didn't talk about it because it's so sensationalized, or could be. You know, this whole area is so sensationalized. And starting about 15 years ago, I started to talk about it in my classes. For years, I taught in a university setting at University of California, Santa Cruz, in a program which trains social change activists. And and part of my work is in feminist studies also. And so in teaching about women and violence, one of the things that I've done in my classes is talk about all the different kinds of structural violence that women and girls face and the different options that we have to respond to it. And so at some point, I started talking about my experience and why understanding racism and sexism and the way they came together there, it was necessary to create a different solution. And the other thing is I think it was important to me to tell people that there are different kinds of experiences that people have about rape. And so often, you know, we think of a woman who's been raped as someone who's a victim, not just then, but afterwards. But in my mind, especially because there's this continuum of what rape is between a little bit of pressure and a lot of violence, that it's important for people to understand that you can respond. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what the forces are that arrayed against you, there is a way to have a dignified response. So that was something I learned in Arkansas, and something that gave me a tremendous appreciation for my coworkers in SNCC, that I felt I could really depend on them in this really difficult situation.
Right.
I just wanted to share with you.
Yeah. I mean, was there a sense of other stories? Like, did you hear other stories about this happening with other volunteers or within the movement?
Well, you know, there was a lot of... are you talking about sexual stuff?
Yeah, I was just wondering about, you know, the community that you reached out to and that reached out to you about what, you know, that how supportive it was and what you sort of knew about, you know, what else might be going on. I mean, if other people are having similar experiences.
I know when I was at Waveland that there were some women who talked about having been assaulted while they were at Waveland. But that was within SNCC.
Mm-hmm.
And people are drunk, all kind of things happen. And I think that generally my experience in the movement was that the people who welcomed you into
mm-hmm.
the community or into the organization or the sub-organization that you were part of treated you like a sister or brother
mm-hmm.
and did everything they could to make sure that you were safe. I mean, when we think of these stories of how people brought out their shotguns or rifles, you know, to protect this or that center or make sure that nothing happened to you. But to me, that's what the experience was like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of what happened to me as a kind of a fluke that involved someone, you know, it was an acquaintance rape by someone who really wasn't part of the community.
Right.
It was somebody who participated in some event, like, you know, some march that we had or something like that, but he wasn't really a part of the community. And of course, this kind of demonstrated that he wasn't part of the community.
Do you think that people heard your calls from the apartment in that complex?
Definitely. There were people with lights on nearby. Well, it could be that I assumed that they heard me,
mm-hmm.
and that they didn't, but I could have been wrong.
Right.
But as I remembered it at the time, as I remember, that was one of the things that was so hard for me, and it also brought home to me very much the fact that I was a white woman in a black community,
right.
and that therefore kind of a danger
mm-hmm.
to the community, and you know, would somebody really want to get involved with this? And I didn't blame the people for not responding. I want to make that really clear.
Right.
I'm not the kind of person who would say, what's wrong with them? They don't care that something's happened to this white woman. I was caught in a situation
mm-hmm.
that was impossible
mm-hmm.
for people to respond to. Just like it was impossible for me to turn to what I'm supposed to turn to, you know, something like that. To me, the nature of the story is about the, you know, something bad happens and you have to figure out how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much what the bad thing is.
Right. And did you stay working?
Oh yeah, I continued to work. This was in early in the year, and it was after that my boyfriend, later my husband, came. I told him about what had happened. And he also wanted to know who this person was. And I refused to identify.
Hmm.
Because I didn't want it to continue.
Right.
I just wanted this person to be completely out of my life and not have to see him or anything. And if Donald had known, that would have just continued. But I continued to work there. I was there for another 7 or 8 months or something, and I think I changed my behavior a little. And I love my work.
Mm-hmm.
I was
mm-hmm.
very happy there. I love the people I work with. The people that I met in Arkansas were fabulous, especially out in our different projects.
What was going on out in the counties?
Well, there was voter registration.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of community education. There was a lot more voter registration going on in the rural areas. And then we had at these freedom schools, we had these citizenship courses. How does the electoral process work? What's registration about? What does it mean to vote? And we had black history courses and programs for kids. kind of problem-solving at the local level. So I didn't work in the, out in the country
mm-hmm.
side. My job was more to supply the centers with what people wanted. So occasionally I would come out for some event that we would have. And in fact, somebody, I saw this photo that somebody took of me where I was present, where people were putting in a garden somewhere.
Mm.
It was like some project we were involved in,
right.
planting vegetables.
Right.
So you never know what it's like.
And then after, and then you went back to graduate school?
Then I went back to graduate school, and I continued to work with the Boston Action Group
mm-hmm.
on those things, and then I got involved with this group that focused in the white community called People Against Racism,
mm-hmm.
which had a chapter in the Boston area. So we would primarily do like workshops and educational activities about history of white racism,
mm.
and also do participate in certain kind of solidarity activities that were led by African Americans in the black community. That was a period of time that was in 66, 67, 68, when there was a kind of rise of the Black Power movement,
right.
and so the person I was married to was very involved in that movement. And so one of the things that happened was that he was criticized because he was married to somebody white. And so we had to deal with that. And that also for me, I was very supportive of the Black Power movement. I never felt threatened by it.
Mm-hmm.
I always felt that it was completely rational,
mm-hmm.
completely.
Mm-hmm. In
and
what way? Did it seem like a natural
well,
next step,
you know,
or?
I never, you know, some, I think that some of the people I knew that were in the movement who were white, they felt hurt
mm-hmm.
That they were being rejected somehow. And to me, I didn't feel that way. I felt that it was reasonable. I always believed in black leadership in the movement. And I felt that it was reasonable for people to say, well, you know, we want to figure out what we want to do and we're going to figure it out ourselves. And there's a huge issue over here, which is white racism. And you can, you know, go ahead
right.
and work on it. And
I mean,
there's plenty of things to do. So I always felt that was fine. And I also felt that there are plenty of things that white people can do to support black organizing directly. And I continued to be involved in doing that. Like that story about the Hood Milk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people that I was working with overwhelmingly were black, but there was something that a white person could do.
Right.
And I was happy to do that. I believed in what they were doing, and I never felt like I was unimportant. I was doing what I could do. So I continued that.
Right. Now, so you were working with People Against Racism. Was your husband in the same group, or was he involved in other organizations?
No, he was working with other groups in the black community that were African-American focused.
Right.
So, People Against Racism was a white group. There were some black people who connected to it in different ways, but it was basically both. I mean, and we would do programs. Sometimes there'd be a program where we do something which would involve African Americans, because there's some things that, you know, a white person doesn't know because they haven't had the experience of being black. And sometimes it's good for white people to hear from black people as well as from white people. Often, I'd say it's good. But when we would cooperate with people, we would sponsor programs, etc. So there was cooperation, but it was basically a white organization.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But you're each going to your different meetings, and then
we go to our different meetings, and we hang out together. We also had a kid, and both of our families were opposed to us getting married. So, you know, his mother thought that I just wanted to use him, and my mother thought we were going to be rejected by people. In fact, when he and I got married, we got married in Boston, and we were married by a minister who worked in the Arkansas Project, who came up from Arkansas, Ben Greenwich, And he married us in Cambridge. This is where we lived, in Cambridge, Mass. And oh, and the other thing my husband did, he was one of the people that ran the Friends of SNCC store in Cambridge, where we would sell things to raise money for SNCC. So it was, you know, family activities.
Right.
So, but when we got married, it would have been illegal for us to get married in Virginia.
Right.
At that time, the law still forbid marriage between African Americans and whites.
So you got married in Massachusetts?
Well, we were living in Massachusetts also. But
right.
but just to kind of give you a sense of what the what the atmosphere was like at the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people came from both sides of the family to the wedding, even though they were suspicious. Everybody was suspicious of the other side. And it was interesting to me also, because later when my daughter was born, and I would take her out when she was little, people couldn't understand how I could have a darker-skinned child than me. It's interesting. It just told you something about racism. How racism operates. People can understand a person who they identify as African American having a lighter skin child, somewhat lighter skin, but they couldn't understand how a person who they thought was white could have a darker skin child.
Mm-hmm.
This is a whole other story.
Right.
We'll leave that one.
Okay. So where do you want to go from here? And should we wrap up now, or do you? Maybe I could just
say how this experience affected me afterwards.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, we could talk for hours.
But there are a lot of things. I'll just say that. I think, like a lot of people who worked for SNCC and were active in the movement, that was a period of time in my life, starting basically when I was about 17, because I was 17 years old my first year of college. Till my mid-20s, I think that's a time in your life where often some of your basic values and tastes are set, and that really happened to me. Like, my taste in music were affected very much, but my basic kind of political education occurred through SNCC, I think. You know, I had some liberal values, and I was brought up to be somewhat assertive, and so on and so forth, but understanding the value of democracy in an organization, seeing how a non-hierarchical organization could work, the idea that we are our bodies and everybody has a body and everybody can use that body, the emphasis on action as opposed to theory and intellectual activity, the belief that lines and barriers are they're part of a system of power and oppression, and that we have the right to cross over those barriers, and that ethical and moral issues or ethical and moral beliefs are more important than laws. All these things I got from working in the SNCC.
Mm-hmm.
And also the belief that you can create. You don't have to be skilled. Now, the first time I ended up being trained as a sociologist, but the first time I ever did sociological research was when I was in Prince Edward County and people wanted to do a voter registration survey, and somebody said, "Oh, you took sociology in college, you designed the survey." And I went, "What? I can't do that." And they said, "Oh, of course you can do that." You know, and so I had to do it. I just had to figure, well, I guess we have to ask people, you know, how many people live in the house and so on and so forth. And I made up the survey and we put it out on the Ditto machine and people took it out and surveyed people in the county. Well, that understanding that you can do it. And then also, I learned a lot, especially in Arkansas, about my own privilege in education and how to let go of that and not speak up and how to transfer skills, and how to accept that somebody didn't spell the way I spelled. And that was also a fabulous education that I brought with me from SNCC. And since I worked in SNCC, I worked for years training social change activists. I was very involved in the women's health movement. I've been involved in the lesbian gay movement. I work around prison health and prison abolition issues. Now I'm also involved in stuff about Israel and Palestine, and on a bunch of different levels. I've been arrested. I work in the anti-apartheid movement. Mm-hmm. All these things, my interest, my willingness to just go out there and get arrested or whatever, comes from that strength that I got, maybe that, you know, even those first days.
Mm-hmm.
It happened to me that when I was teaching, I got denied tenure because of my politics when I was at UC Santa Cruz in the early 80s. And my department supported me, the faculty supported me, the head of the campus thought I was too radical and so on. And it got challenged.
Mm-hmm.
I won.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, it took about 5 years.
Yeah.
But in the process, we did a tremendous amount of education because my work was very much, it basically came out of these values. It was about asking women prisoners what they thought of their health, as opposed to talking to the doctors.
Right.
It was about teaching about activism by having students go and apprentice to social change groups. It was about basically bringing the values of SNCC into academia,
mm-hmm.
and in the areas that I was interested in. Well, so when we did the organizing, the fundraising, we had we have a concert that would be women of color doing different kinds of women's music, and we had cultural events that focused on issues in the gay community, and everything was done in a kind of multicultural, multiracial way, which gave people on the campus a chance to get together and know each other across these lines.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was being fired specifically for these values, people who believed in those values supported the struggle. And it became a kind of a feminist struggle, and
mm-hmm.
it was a struggle about dealing with issues of racism in the university and so on and so forth. And so it was a kind of community victory,
mm-hmm.
When we won. And at the same time, the campus changed because of it. I was the first out lesbian faculty member to come up for tenure. And I was denied, but then I finally got it.
Right.
But now that campus has lots and lots of lesbian faculty and gay faculty. And it also established a kind of sense that everybody belonged. I mean, there were a lot of other movements taking place at the same time, you know, the ethnic studies movement, et cetera. And to me, I feel like I owe to SNCC my approach to teaching and research. And I also owe to SNCC the fact that I got to keep my job because of this change in culture that I think SNCC was part of.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of whether it's people's history or talking to people about their own experience in institutions as opposed to having some professional say what the institutions are really doing. You have the people
right.
who are directly affected by them saying it. So even though I'm not necessarily you know, I'm not still in SNCC.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that what I do expresses what I learn. So my whole life, I think, has been affected by that.
Mm-hmm.
Gave me some fabulous skills. And I got confidence that these values work, that you can organize from the grassroots. People can do anything. And participating in that and actually seeing it work,
mm-hmm.
that to me, that's like so valuable. There's no substitute for that. I hope everybody gets that sometime.
Yeah. What has it been, I mean, this might be a little bit of a hokey question, but what is it like for you this weekend?
Does it seem strange
that it's 50 years later?
Well, when I heard that there was going to be the 50th anniversary, and I didn't go to the previous anniversaries.
Yeah.
I live in California also.
Right.
I kept going, I can't believe it. It was 50 years ago. How could it be 50 years ago? And I kept going around saying to my friends, 50 years ago? How could it be 50 years ago? And then I kept saying, well, I was only 17. I was 17. 17. I was 50 years ago when I was 17. So that was one big part of it. And I was a little bit nervous about coming because, well, you know, Arkansas is kind of on the edge of SNCC, and SNCC has kind of, in many ways, always been focused on Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama. And also, I knew some people in D.C. I knew some people here. I knew some people there. And I always felt like, yeah, I was in a supportive role for a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And would I know very many people? So I didn't know how it would work.
Mm-hmm.
And since I've been here for a day and a half, I've met various people that I knew way back when. And, of course, some of them remembered me and told one person, Hank Thomas, that I knew from D.C. NAG, he was speaking, he said something, I went up and I introduced myself, and he told me that he remembered coming to my house, and that, because the picket line was, you know, just a short walk from my house, and he'd come over to my house, you know, my family house there, and I think he actually spent the night there one time, and he said to me, well, we were just talking in one of these rooms, he said, was your father a science fiction, was it your father was a science fiction writer? I said, I didn't know what he's talking about. And he said, I'm sure I remember being at your house in a science fiction. And then I remember that my father used to love to read science fiction. And Hank said, and he liked comics or something. And it was like these Amazing Stories magazines, which
right.
he used to have subscriptions to all these science fiction magazines. And I said, yeah, that's right. And all of a sudden, it was like, through Hank's visual image of what we did then, I was transported back into a part of my life that I'd forgotten.
Mm.
And I think maybe because it was so personal, and my father had died very soon thereafter also. And so later in the meeting, I've run into a couple of times in the meeting, and we always give each other these big hugs, you know. And I feel like I, from not only from my conversation with him, but from some other people, some things that kind of disappeared, like the names of some of the people that I knew then, or particular places that we went that I had lost, I've gotten back because they remember things that I forgot. And so that I feel like a part of myself I'm kind of getting back. And then the other thing is that there are people that I knew that now when I see them, they look so different. You know, and I have to say, well, it was 40 years ago when we last saw each other.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, some people are kind of still recognizable. And also, people have the same personalities.
Right.
And some of the people that I worked with, you know, I'm thinking of like Ivanhoe Donaldson or Corley Cox, or, you know, some of the other people who are here, they saw the same intelligence, same kind of sweetness, which I to me, is kind of a hallmark of SNCC.
Mm-hmm.
I think the people that were able to work in SNCC were people who had strength and gentleness both, and so it's kind of wonderful to be around people who were there and survived.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some people here have talked about this kind of post-traumatic stress syndrome, but I haven't really talked to people who seem to be suffering from it.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like the people that I have talked to have somehow been able to integrate these terrible experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And keep their affection for the world. And so that's been great for me. And seeing how many people how everybody is still active in one thing or another.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
is fabulous.
Yeah.
So I feel like my community has been expanded again. It's
mm-hmm.
not just the people that I know that I work with, but it's like people who I knew then, they've maybe become again part of my family
mm-hmm.
because I've touched them and seen them.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like if I kind of reach out or something, they're there. So that's a great feeling. I feel like I got that from this people.
Wonderful.
it's great. It is wonderful. You know, so. Better than intending what my high school reunion would be like.
Well, thank
okay.
you. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, well,
yeah.
This is just kind of emotional for me,
yeah.
but I'm glad. Maybe you can explain to me how I'll ever be able to see
yeah.
it or hear it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.